For an even better way to listen to Football Weekly at home, at work or on the go, head to soundcloud.com/Guardian Football Weekly or download the SoundCloud app for Android and iPhone.
Football Weekly Extra.
Today, Four Champions League last 16. Holy tasty wafer, it's papal parallels time as Milan's chances end in a puff of smoke, while in Munich there's much pontificating after Arsenal's brave but doomed comeback bid v Bayern means all English clubs are out before the quarters. Never mind, we're providing the stadium. Who'll be playing there? Could it be Malaga or Galatasaray? Our panel predicts. Elsewhere, Premier League weekend. Extraordinary situation at Reading. Toffees against Man City. Ooh, Aston Villa QPR. That plus your post, your tweets, and so much more in this Football Weekly Extra. There you go. What can we say? Football Weekly Extra after another extraordinary midweek of European football. Here, Jacob Steinberg.
Hello, James.
You've been all over that European thing, haven't you, in the last couple of days?
Yeah. Barcelona, Arsenal.
Wow.
The games.
Absolutely. Michael Cox.
Hello. Yeah, I watched three of them, but not the Arsenal-Bayern game, I'm afraid.
People might suggest you made the right call on that yet again, Michael.
Well, I don't know if I did, actually. It was similar to last year. I didn't watch Arsenal's second leg against Milan and then suddenly changed channels frantically, hoping for a comeback. And did the same with 5 minutes to go here, and it didn't materialise.
It didn't materialise, did it? No. And Raphael, what did you watch?
Hello, I did watch Arsenal.
Hey!
Nearly dumping Bayern out of the competition, and Bayern would have deserved to go out after this abject shower of a performance.
Right, well, there you go. Laying it on the line. We're going to talk a little bit more in depth about those games. You'll be delighted to know. Are we going to start with Barcelona?
Yes.
Yes, we are, Jacob. Yes, we are. They're back.
Were they ever gone?
Yeah, apparently so. But they're back now.
It was a sensational performance from Barcelona. They almost played like they were affronted by the criticism they've received over the last couple of weeks, you know, the defeats they'd had to Real Madrid. And so you got your hand up there.
No, I just wondering if it more than criticism they were affronted by particularly
their own
weak
performances.
Milan.
No, well, Milan played very well in that first leg, didn't they? But in the big pitch, the better pitch, they looked a little bit overawed. They're still a young side developing. And I saw Paolo Bandini was criticising Allegri for playing Pazzini the other night and then losing him to injury, which meant they lost another experienced player, especially as Balotelli wasn't able to play in that game against Genoa on Friday night because he was cup-tied. And Milan just kind of froze a little bit, and when Barcelona got that first goal, he felt it was going to be a very long night for them.
Mm. People are calling it one of their greatest performances. Do you know what you would feel about that, Michael?
I wouldn't go along with that in terms of the overall quality. Mm. I mean, I think that the thing that let them down was, surprisingly, of all teams, you expect Barcelona, once they've got the advantage in the tie, to keep the ball, to keep control, to defend proactively. And I thought they allowed Milan too much pressure. And there's a couple of moments, particularly when Alba made a very good tackle on Robinho about 8 minutes from the end.
Ooh,
really
yeah.
good tackle.
Lovely and, bit of play by Bojan there, who didn't seem to be overawed by the
he seemed maybe at a point to prove back at Barcelona. But I mean, it was a very good performance, a remarkable turnaround. It was the first time I've really not been confident Barcelona would progress. So it was extraordinary in that sense, but I don't think it was an amazing performance.
I kept on saying during the minute by minute, they need another goal when it was 3-0, because you just feel that it doesn't take a lot for them to concede. And to have that much possession and still be so vulnerable, you do wonder whether they do have the capability of winning this tournament against sides that have better strikers. And for Milan to probably come away thinking they should have scored twice with the Niang chance and the Robinho chance, you'd still be worried about Barcelona's defence, I think.
Hmm. Raphael?
I think it was interesting because there was almost a pattern this year that teams who have a strong performance in the first leg somehow don't quite deliver in the second one. Perhaps in a false sense of security, thinking that they've done it because they've perhaps achieved a better result than they'd hoped for, like Bayern, like Milan, completely sort of sleepwalking into the defeat. And I think on another day Milan would have looked at a Barcelona team and would have deducted, as especially exactly what Jacob was saying, that they still have vulnerabilities at the back. They've been conceding a lot of goals. The pressing isn't quite as good as it used to be or as intense, and they just never really came out their own half.
That said, Barcelona did win 4-0, and
they did
the Messi goals, eh?
They did, yeah. I mean, I don't think it's even worth talking about. It was too good.
That good,
words won't add anything. You just have to watch it again and again and again. I think it's better than the Ronaldinho one. It was compared to the Ronaldinho one at Chelsea. I think this one's better because there are a lot more players closer to him. Ronaldinho was almost stationary. No one was coming to him, and he can just look up and hit it from a standing position, whereas Messi was in full flow and people were at him, behind him, underneath him, on top of him. It was wonderful to watch.
Yeah, he makes it look too easy almost to appreciate properly. You have to watch it several times where you realise just how tough it is what he's done. Extraordinary. I did enjoy the second goal as well, actually.
Offside, though.
Yeah, that's fair. Mm-hmm. But does, I think in this case, there's a certain artistic license one allows, yeah, isn't there? Yeah. Certainly the commentary said his fault. So. Sid Lowe, on the line in Spain, is it?
Hello, James.
Hi, Sid. Where, are you back home?
I am, yes.
All right. How did that train trip go?
The train trip was all right, thank
yeah.
you.
Yeah. And then you went to the Camp Nou, and was that a terrific night?
Oh, it was brilliant. The way the Barcelona played, the response from the crowd, and a lot of English people who've been to the Camp Nou before will almost certainly tell you that it can be really disappointing in terms of atmosphere. But it was spectacular on Tuesday night, and I thought Barcelona were brilliant. That they finally recovered some of the things that they've been lacking the last 4 or 5 weeks, and played the way that they do when they're at their best, because they need the physical and kind of mental intensity to go with the quality that they've got. Otherwise, they're just not as good a side.
Right. So what was the key difference for them that turned things around?
Well, I think if you go through it, you can pick up two or three factors. I think one of them fundamentally was the fact that they were pressing. And they haven't really done that as much this year as previously. Pedro pushed them very high up the pitch. Messi was playing higher. So rather than becoming an extra midfielder, he was an extra forward. By playing David Villa up front, and not up front in that kind of left side coming in role that he sometimes played before, but up front. And Jordi Raldo, the coach, was afterwards talking about Villa fixing the two centre-backs and allowing Messi and the inside forwards, in other words, basically Iniesta, to have space to come towards the penalty area. That was important. I thought they were quicker to every single ball. And if you look at the goals, I think I'm right in saying that all four of them come from Barcelona robbing the ball. A couple of times slightly deeper, but a couple of times really quite high up the pitch. And I think it was that intensity more than anything else. Dani Alves pushed very, very high and very, very wide, so almost as if he was an extra forward rather than a fullback, which you might say, well, that's normal. Well, not really, because it tends to be a starting point is deeper. This time he was right at the top, and the whole of the Barcelona team just much, much more aggressive.
Xavi coming back into the side for this game, there has been some suggestion that his time on the sidelines actually proved invaluable to Barca.
Well, I think there's no doubt about that. This is a guy that's been struggling with a couple of injuries over the last couple of years. He's had Achilles problems. He's got thigh problems. I think he's 33 now. He might be 32. I think he's 33 now. And actually, I think he's a player, a bit like Xabi Alonso at Real Madrid, that needs protecting. So the injury, which they said, right, he'll be back in 2 weeks, it always felt like one of those injuries that, well, if there hadn't been a big Milan game coming up, and if the league games had perhaps been more important, maybe he wouldn't have been injured. It was more a case of, right, let's take him out, let's protect him, let's prepare him, and let's get him back in time. He comes back, by the way, he's already injured again, so he won't play this weekend. So this is someone that they will need to look after, but they need to get him right for the games that really matter. And I suspect now, and it would be logical, that they'll continue to do that in the Champions League games, that they'll continue to say, right, let's protect the players that really matter. And just as Madrid would do with Xabi Alonso, I think we'll see something similar with Xavi Hernandez.
I was actually hinting at the fact that there were stories that his time observing the team and the way that they had suffered against certainly Real Madrid led him to make some pretty important points. I'm just wondering if he's beginning to take or exert some sort of managerial or tactical influence on the team.
Well, I wouldn't go quite so far as to say that he was out and therefore could see it, because I think he could see it when he was in. And I think to some extent everybody could see it. And he listened to the players talking before the game. And Dani Alves gave a very interesting interview in one of the Madrid-based papers, not the sports ones, El Mundo. And he was talking about that lack of intensity and said sometimes we've not had the hunger and the desire and the aggression. And he was talking specifically about the pressure. And I think that was the thing that most changed. And I don't think Xabi Hernandez needed to be not playing to see that. There's no doubt at all that players have stepped up and taken on a more significant role over the last 5 or 6 weeks in the absence of, in fact, it's 9 weeks now, isn't it, in the absence of Tito Villanova. That's certainly true. I don't think there's any doubt at all that Xabi Hernandez has always been more than the player, that he sees the game in very, very specific, very narrow, and a lot of non-Barcelona fans dislike him for this, very narrow, very Barcelona terms. And he's certainly someone who's always been consulted on these sort of things, and I think will take a step up now. He's somebody that everybody sees as a coach in the future. Although in the interview that I did with him a couple of years ago, he said he wouldn't fancy the pressure of coach, but he'd love to be involved in the club, maybe at youth team level. So I think certainly he would have had an input. But to the extent of saying, take him out of the team so he can watch, no, I don't think so.
I don't think anybody would deny that Cesc Fabregas is a brilliant player. But what do you think Tuesday night did for him?
I think Tuesday night went a long way to pushing him three or four extra players down the pecking order. There's been a real desire to get him involved, and at times it's worked. Earlier on this season, I think Barcelona forfeited some of the control to have that ability to arrive from deeper, which Cesc is so good at. But Fabregas is a guy who I think performs slightly better when the game is a little bit looser, when it's a little bit less controlled. I think it's very, very difficult to find a logical place for him in the team because, of course, Xavi and Iniesta will get. And it strikes me that Barcelona have taken too long to put Iniesta in the middle of midfield rather than as one of the front three. Or sometimes Iniesta's been in midfield and Cesc has been part of the front three. But while Messi is there, Cesc's natural space is kind of occupied. And while Xavi and Iniesta are there, his other option, the other natural space for him, is also occupied. And I think Tuesday night kind of reinforced that. I don't think anyone didn't realise that. I think everybody realised that. But I think it really reinforced it. And I think it means that we'll see him play a role in the big games, at least, where he's less likely to start. I think he'll start a lot in La Liga to try and protect Xavi Hernandez. And long-term, of course, bear in mind he's still very young, he will, I think, end up taking that central role. But certainly, yeah, Tuesday night, I think pushed him a long way back and a long way further away from the team. And while Messi, Iniesta and Xavi are all fit, it's difficult to see exactly how they crowbar him in. And part of their problem was that they were trying to crowbar him in.
Right. Sid, Malaga, how about them, hey? Their first time in the Champions League did look like maybe they'd lost a little bit of their sparkle of late, but there they are in the quarterfinals. And Manuel Pellegrini, the only man in history to take two Champions League debutantes to the quarters.
Yeah,
Villarreal, the precedent.
Villarreal, who of course went to the semis as well. Yeah. And depending on the draw, then Malaga, who knows if Malaga might make it to semi-finals. I thought the first half yesterday was awful. It was really scrappy, really, and the sending off was absurd. The Porto sending off was absurd. I think it was Dufour, wasn't it, who had two or three really bad challenges before the one that finally got him sent off. And then Malaga started to come into it. Isco is the key player for them. And as you say, I mean, Pellegrini's success with them, I think, is similar if you look at the way they played to how Villarreal did. Fundamentally, they're defensively strong, but they, broadly speaking, defend themselves with possession rather than defend themselves by having, you know, being very deep, being very aggressive. They're quite a smooth side. And the main thing, really, with Pellegrini, I think, is that he's been able to handle some of the off-field problems really, really well. And I think he's been able to create a situation in which he and the players kind of come together, not quite against the club, because that would be too strong, but they come together as if you like, kind of self-defending between themselves. They become a group that's really, really strong. And I think he's developed that. And you look at the players that he's lost, Cazorla, Monreal and so on, and they've been able to overcome that. And they've been able to keep the basics right. And with Isco, they've got that little touch of something different that I think makes them really dangerous.
Brilliant. Well, in they go to the hat for the quarterfinals, the big draw, of course, on Friday. Sid, that's magnificent stuff. And look forward to catching up with you after the weekend.
Fantastic. Speak to you then.
Cheers, Sid.
Cheerio.
Sid Lowe, very much in Spain. Bayern Arsenal. Now, Rafa, there's a lot been said about Bayern. Is it the case that they just didn't have to actually try any harder in this game?
I think that was a major problem for them, was the mental attitudes towards this game. Hank has made a change. It was natural. He brought in Javi Martinez for Schweinsteiger, who was course suspended, but the balance of midfield wasn't right because you had two very defensive midfielders and Kroos, and that extra man that can play sort of both roles, the defensive role and the deep playmaker role, in Schweinsteiger was missing, and Martinez looked very, very poor on the ball. He's a great ball winner, has been really making a big difference in terms of defensive stability for Bayern, but when he was tasked with a bit more creativity yesterday, it wasn't coming, and a lot of the players just seemed a little bit in two minds all the time. And I think the early goal from Arsenal made it even more difficult to approach the game, because then they really weren't sure, you know, whether to hold this lead, which was still effectively a two-goal lead, or scored a goal that would kill the tie. And it was a big mishmash of a sort of half-heartedness, half-bakedness. And in the end, with Heynckes making yet another defensive substitution, they were gagging a bit for it a little bit. And they would have, I think, deserved almost to get knocked out because they were so poor yesterday.
Well, they came close. 2-0, which meant that they were tied on aggregate, but the away goals seeing Bayern through. A game that was strangely in limbo, Jacob, for much of it.
It was a weird game. It didn't feel like there was a lot of tension because Arsenal got that early goal, but then didn't do a lot of attacking, to be honest. They had a slight half chance with Giroud at the far post. Jovinho had that toe poke which sort of slithered wide, and then kind of the game was drifting, and then suddenly it was 2-0 because Chelsea scored this goal from the corner. Arsenal, though, it's being painted as and talked about as a heroic effort, glorious failure, but again, they've done it when the pressure isn't on, when it's not the most important moment of the tie. If you hadn't lost that game 3-1 against Bayern Munich, now you wonder why they lost that game 3-1. And they've done it so many times this season. They've been 2-0 down against big sides, and then they've come back, maybe scored a goal, and then kind of drifted out. Same as against Milan last year as well.
Far be it from me to enter into a Skynet T-800 time paradox scenario, but had they not lost 3-1 in the first leg, Bayern wouldn't have played like this in the second leg, so there wouldn't have been this kind of opportunity anyway.
True. But, you know, Arsenal will... A lot of people are praising Arsenal for last night, but do it when it really matters.
Right. Get up to dance while the band haven't packed up yet. That would be the key thing there. Wenger getting ruthless, though. A lot of people are excited about that. Wojciech Szczesny, ruthlessly axed. Thomas Vermaelen, similar.
Yeah, I don't think...
Mental issues for Szczesny.
I don't think either of them have performed well this season, which I think is a blow for Arsenal because they did seem like, even though both are not particularly experienced, they did seem like leaders in that dressing room. You know, Vermaelen's got the captaincy. A lot of people like Szczesny because he was a big presence. But a lot of people at Arsenal quite like Fabianski. Apparently he's been impressing Wenger recently, and I think this was on the cards for a few weeks. So I wouldn't be surprised if he kept his place ahead of the game against Swansea.
Right, OK, because Bayern coming out of this losers, but they're through to the quarterfinals. Arsenal, what do they come out of this with?
It's an interesting question because they look a lot more solid defensively than they have done for a long time in this game. And before that, I don't know if you saw it, Wenger was kind of asked very specifically if they'd done any work defensively after the recent shambles against Bayern, but also in the derby. And you'd expect him almost to sniff at this kind of question. But this time he really addressed it and he said, yes, we did. And you could feel it was genuine and that they were working and they didn't have a game. And I think, you know, suddenly people are saying, oh, you know, Mertesacker's not so bad. Well, maybe, you know, a bit of good coaching makes everyone look a little bit better. And that's not rocket science. And you wonder if this is a good thing because perhaps Wenger's doing more of it, or it just shows you what's gone wrong before, that it just wasn't enough coaching going on. And so I don't know if you want to take that as a positive, maybe that he's changing things, or you see, you know, this is actually pretty bad because everyone's been made to look very bad. Because the instructions coming from the bench aren't good enough.
A lot of people figure that Mertesacker looks much better with Koscielny as his partner as opposed to Vermaelen. Certainly that seemed to be the case against Bayern.
Well, they're completely different players for me. I mean, Vermaelen insists on coming up towards the play and winning the ball quickly, and Koscielny is a little bit more reserved and sweeps up behind. And, you know, the obvious criticism with Mertesacker is his lack of pace, so he needs someone sweeping up behind him.
Mm. All right, well, that certainly makes sense. Now, Arsenal face 9 games to make the top 4 if they're to feature in this competition again next season. Tall order?
Tall order, but Spurs have done them a favour by losing at Liverpool. I think that was the kind of result that they needed at least to get a point to feel a bit more confident. And now, with them going probably far in the Europa League, you wonder if Arsenal are not just going to go on another run like they often do towards the end of the season, a little bit like in the big games when it almost seems like it's too late. Then they suddenly start playing again,
right,
and come away not with a triumph but with a sort of a minimum result, which for them is always fourth spot.
Well, Chelsea are the nearest team to them, five points ahead of the Gunners, and they equally have Europa League concerns. Europa League going on Thursday evening, there's very little we can say about that. Of course, for Arsenal, it's a trip to Swansea. Yikes. Now, they have got a trophy.
They have, and they have already beaten Arsenal this season in the league at the Emirates. And I think that if Swansea were to do the double over Arsenal, and I should point out there was an FA Cup tie that Arsenal eventually progressed from in between these games, but if Swansea do the double over Arsenal, I think it would be quite damning, really, considering their limited resources compared to Arsenal. You know, we know that Arsenal will struggle with physicality and long balls and the Stokes and Boltons of this world, but if they lose twice in a season to Swansea, I think that would be quite something.
Playing them at their own game.
Yeah, exactly. And at the Emirates, even though it was two late goals for Michu, I think 87 and 91 minutes, they did deserve that. And Wenger, you know, happily came out and conceded Arsenal had been outplayed in that game.
Mm. No Jack Wilshere. And that's going to be the case for, well, estimates vary.
About 3 weeks.
Three weeks.
Back
now.
On 30th of March.
Okay.
But, you know, the way it was last time. You worry a little bit.
Well, of course, that's by far the end of the Champions League midweek action. There's still Galatasaray to laud and applaud, so we'll be doing that after this.
This week on the Guardian Audio Edition, David Cameron may last, even as he leads his MPs to their doom. Hugo Chavez, the poor boy from the plains who became a left-wing figurehead. Google Glass, is it a threat to our privacy? And in this week's audiobook review, we return to a classic of children's literature, Clive King's Stig of the Dump, and set off on a brand new adventure series with Andrew Beasley's The Battles of Ben Kingdom. To subscribe for free to the Guardian Audio Edition, go to audible.co.uk/guardian. Or find us on SoundCloud, iTunes, and Audioboo. The Guardian Audio Edition, a new way to get the whole picture.
Hey, a lot of excitement in Turkey. You'll be surprised to hear about Galatasaray going through to the quarterfinals of the Champions League, Raphael. Beating your friend Schalke.
Yeah, they're not my personal friends,
no.
Schalke, but
I
see
what, you, at the same time.
What you're getting at. All Germans are kind of in the same...
Lumping you in the same...
boat, yep. All 80 million of us. It was an unnecessary defeat for Schalke's point of view because they completely threw away the first half. Despite taking the lead, they never really got going. And the Galatasaray side, who they've got passion, they've got Drogba, they've got Terim on the sideline doing his thing.
Pride and pace. And power.
And they've got Yilmaz, who's been quite brilliant in front of goals, scoring loads of goals, leading goal scorer along with Messi in the Champions League. But it's not a great team.
Really?
Neither are Schalke, but Schalke did enough in the second half. Where they were really going for it and created a lot of chances without Huntelaar, who was injured. So that was a big problem for them. They didn't perhaps have anyone to take all these chances that they created. But it was a missed opportunity because after 60 minutes, you could see that Drogba was really struggling to keep up with the pace of the game along with one or two other players. And I think they're not the worst team to draw on Friday.
Right, because Drogba's presence, given what happened last season, I think... has led a lot of people to thinking of Galatasaray as potential dark horses. Michael, would you write them off as well?
I think they're probably the worst team left in the competition.
Really?
Yeah, I thought they did okay. I mean, Drogba was, of the three attackers, Yilmaz, Schneider and Drogba, Drogba was the most ineffective, I thought. I think the only thing going for Galatasaray is that Terim switched to like a diamond midfield. And it's so rare to see that at the top level, especially in the Champions League at the moment, that I thought Schalke kind of took a while to figure out how to play against them. I mean, at the weekend, they were brilliant down the flanks, but Galatasaray got out very quickly and shut down Uchida and the left-back Kolasinac. But the one time that the free man was Hoga in the midfield, the one time he went through, he kind of got in behind the defence for a half chance, but he didn't really take advantage. And I thought it was just about... Schalke kind of took too long to work out what they had to do, really.
All right, well, they're through to the quarterfinals anyway. Malaga, Juventus, Barcelona, Real Madrid, Bayern Munich, Borussia Dortmund and Paris Saint-Germain, the other teams there. Jacob, you're calling this one of the most wide-open Champions Leagues ever.
Yeah, no, I was saying to you before, you could make a case for about probably five teams winning the tournament, I think.
Right.
Yeah.
Is that not usually the case at the quarterfinals, though?
No, I think sometimes you come to it and you... writing off a few and basically saying this is between one or two sides.
Okay, which three are you not having as contenders?
Malaga, PSG and Galatasaray.
Those words could come back to haunt you.
Yeah, we'll see.
We will, won't we? What do you think, Rafa?
I agree with Jacob to a certain extent. I think Real Madrid look very, very good, but even Barcelona in imperious form have one or two question marks, and you also... beginning to reassess Bayern, maybe unfairly, on the basis of one very, very poor performance where they played like a team leading 3-0 and not believing that the opposition have any chance, and they were nearly punished for that complacency. I don't think we'll ever see that kind of lackluster performance from them again in a quarter final or semi. But everyone looks beatable, and Dortmund in particular look like they can also beat any single team left in this competition. So I think they add this kind of special excitement this year because you could see them going quite far.
All right, one quick word on the Allianz Arena, because a lot of people were saying the game was a little bit flat, the atmosphere was very flat, and people were wondering why that was. You were making some points about this on Twitter yesterday.
Yeah, this has been the case in every single Champions League game, even when they beat Lille, I think 6-1. There was no atmosphere because the guys behind the goal, the buying goal, who are always making all the noise, the ultras, some of them are being displaced because UEFA don't allow the same amount of people in now that these are seats rather than terracing. And they're all over the stadium, and they, in the past, they used to get smuggled in through from mates who were just sort of swapping tickets all the time, taking, you know, a couple of guys out and then three more guys in, that kind of little game. And Bayern have been clamping down on it. They used to turn a blind eye to it. Now, last season, they started saying, you know, we can't do this because you're breaking fire regulations, safety, whatever. If something were to happen, we're all in trouble. But the ultras are not happy with it, so they stay away. And if they're not singing, then Munich is never the loudest of places anyway.
Interesting. Why is it not in the club's interest for them to actually organise this better? OK, they might have a reduced capacity behind the goals, but they could at least make sure that the really hardcore fans do get in there.
Yeah, they've tried. They've been in talks, and I think they did change to allow another extra 200 or so in, but that still means there's 500 or maybe 600 who can't be there,
right,
who are usually there. You just can't physically get them in because they wouldn't have anywhere to sit.
Right.
Is that why Arsenal played well in a kind of muted atmosphere?
Like a home tie, you think, yeah. Michael? Right. What about you, Michael? What's your reading of that group of eight contenders?
I pretty much agree with Jacob. The only thing I'd say is even with PSG, who I don't think are a very good team, I don't think they'll win it. They've probably got more of a chance now than Chelsea did at this stage last season. These things come down to, you know, penalties and refereeing decisions and really fine margins. So I think it is very open.
Right, OK. I'm delighted from Juve's point of view to see you all including them in your five, and just wonder if they're a little bit more limited.
Clinical, aren't they?
They're clinical and indeed cynical.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right, OK. Those teams battling to reach Wembley. Millwall, of course, already there after their midweek win. I bet you all saw this one, didn't you?
About 8,000 people saw this
8,635
saw this. Do you want to talk about no English team being there? I think that is a...
Is that a big thing?
Point. Yeah.
Is it
first
a big
time
thing?
Since 1996?
All right then.
I think you can sometimes read too much into it. I mean, Manchester United were arguably a referee away from beating Real Madrid. They played very well across those two ties, apart from the 10
Arsenal
minutes.
Were only what, 7-8 players away from.
Arsenal are a bit of a shambles at times, and they weren't last night. But defensively, they haven't been a great side. Chelsea and City were in very, very tough groups that a lot of teams would have gone out in. City were in a group with Dortmund and Real Madrid. If they, you know, been in a group, say PSG's group, then they would probably have gone through.
They should have
done better, though, City.
That
they
is true. At the same time, if it wasn't for Chelsea's heroics against Napoli, we would have had the situation already last year. I think there is a pattern, or there's certainly a pattern evolving that saw English dominance drop off from 2008. Every year they had a little bit less success. And now they're back to the mid-90s where they were really behind the times as far as European football is concerned. I agree that there's nothing intrinsically wrong, and you can see them bounce back, and you can see somebody like United having a much bigger impact next season and maybe in Chelsea. The quality and the financial power of the Premier League will always mean that they'll be in the contenders. But I think there is a problem in terms of not utilising the potential that's already there, because they should be doing better relative to what they have. And I think there is a parallel with the mid-90s where also they were miles ahead, or a lot of clubs were miles ahead of the opposition in terms of the finances, but they spent it so poorly that other teams were still getting better results. And I think there is no coincidence that results started dipping in 2008, or after 2008, when something very dramatic happened in the Premier League, which is the emergence of Manchester City. I think that Manchester City's emergence has to a certain extent come at the price of cannibalising other teams.
So the pooling of Premier League talent in one club at Manchester City has weakened the rest of the Champions League contenders. It's an interesting theory, although there's, to a certain extent, it's just sucked in talent from the rest, because the amount of money they've spread around has seen talents coming from all over Europe to other Premier League
clubs. But what
clubs.
They have done, unlike Chelsea, who were in a similar situation in 2003, they've targeted very specifically all the rivals' big players. Some of these moves didn't come off, like Terry and Rooney, but it made these other teams pay more money, money that they didn't want to necessarily spend on these players in keeping them, and cost them in money they could have spent on two or three other players. It's a simplistic view to say, you know, City are the culprits here, but I think they've definitely had an impact. They've skewed the balance of power.
I think it's also the case as well that teams in Europe have definitely got stronger, you know, the emergence of teams like Dortmund and, you know, Shakhtar Donetsk as well, better couple of teams like Malaga, where and Real Madrid as well have reacted to Barcelona, that, you know, that's the stuffings they used to get from Guardiola and getting Mourinho in. For a long time they were very, very poor in Europe and were regularly well beaten by English sides, and they've reacted to that. So it's, I think across Europe it's just a lot more even than it was a couple of years ago.
I think the damning statistic is not this year in isolation, which is a little bit of a one-off, but 2007, 2008, 2009, England had three of the last four in the competition. Mm. And then in the last 4 years, it's been no semi-finalist, one semi-finalist, one semi-finalist, zero semi-finalist. So this year is a blip, but it does fit into the overall pattern. And I think there's also a bit of a problem with the managers that are actually in charge of the elite English clubs. English clubs' dominance started to a certain extent with Mourinho and Benitez coming over, and whatever you think of those two managers, they came over as European winners. Mourinho just won the Champions League, Benitez had just won the UEFA Cup, and there were European specialists, and every year Chelsea and Liverpool were in the semi-finals or thereabouts. You look at the situation now, Mancini's never conquered Europe, he's never got close to conquering Europe. Wenger, I think, is not fared in Europe as well as he has in the Premier League, and obviously Ferguson's been consistent, but I just don't think English clubs have the right mentality, the right structure of the side, and the ability to control games. You know, the top level Premier League games over the last couple of seasons have been so frantic and so open, and that's not conducive to European success. Chelsea are the best example. They weren't a very good team last year, but defensively they were very solid, and they got to the final and won the European Cup.
All right, it's as I thought. The Premier League's just too good for Europe, basically. That's
yeah, you can bet it like that. Yeah.
Okay. Of course, when you say English teams out of the Europa League's where it's at now, Rafa, as you know, and of course tonight that'll see Andy Makachkala taking on Newcastle in Newcastle, where Newcastle are unbeatable, nigh on unbeatable. It'd be an interesting game. That Spurs, of course, over in Milan, and Chelsea. Yep. Stoyer. How are you going to say this one? Debate rages across the continent. Is it Stoyer?
I thought it was Stoyer, but I'm Stoyer. Probably wrong.
My Romanian is right rudimentary.
I'm surprised to hear that, Rafa. I expected more from you. A couple of people picking us up. I say a couple, many, many people picking us up on one or two things we may have said about Scott
Sterling.
Well, that was one of the
that
things.
That was edited out. We said it.
Oh, was that edited out?
Yeah, it must have been edited out.
Oh,
yeah.
Rotten. Yeah. Simpliticans, you've got to feel for Sterling Albion. They beat their neighbours 9-1, a record league win, and the only Scottish result to get a mention south of Hadrian's Wall is a Rangers loss. Yeah, and then the fact that Barry suggested Annan was from the Highlands. They're actually as far as you can get from the Highlands. Points out Mike 65, i.e., as far as you can get from the Highlands is while standing on mainland Scottish soil. Dave Lister, a few Scottish geographical points to make. basically, Annan are just across the border from England. Yeah, sorry about that. It's a faraway distance and very exotic land for us, Scotland. But I think our Scottish listeners will indulge us because they surely don't come here for any knowledge about the SPL. And as wrong as we got it, we're still a lot righter than Jonathan Marler on his Bloomberg blog. Oh, my word. What a colossal boob this man is. Is it satire? Have I missed the point? No. Okay.
Brilliant line of it's unheard of to win two trophies.
If you haven't read it, and you know, I hesitate to publicise it in case they regard the number of hits it might get as in any way vindication of his stance. But he's basically writing a piece about why United fans are xenophobic for having it in for the Glazers just because they're Yanks, in his phrase, and how they should just shut up and enjoy all the success that the Glazers have brought.
Which they mostly have done.
Which is true, in recent
months.
Indeed so. Anyway, if you do fancy a chuckle and are of the patient disposition, you might want to read that. Otherwise, perhaps give it a wide berth. Samuel Hearn says, following James's recognition of the nominative determinism thread, I'd like to nominate Mark Demann, who plays, as you guessed it, centre-half. I'm pretty sure we've done Mark Demann, but just on the off chance we haven't, because that's superb. There he is. Good. That's it for part two. And up next, we're back on the familiar territory of the Premier League with some absolutely huge games in prospect. Michael, when I said huge games in prospect, you made one of your trademark Michael Cox kind of faces. I don't want to call it a sneer, because Michael's a nice chap.
I wasn't inspired, but having looked at it, there's a couple of tasty battles.
Look beyond the big names, Michael.
Yeah, I am Villa QPR. Actually, I was at the reverse fixture of that, and it was very tight. And in fact, QPR dominated, should have won, but that will be a very interesting game.
Right, well, let's talk about that, because it's part of that extraordinary scenario at the bottom where you've got all three bottom teams within 1 point of each other. Yikes. And then a little bit of a gap to the next one up, who are, scratch his memory,
Southampton,
who are hosting
Liverpool.
That's a big game. But hey, I'm getting ahead of myself here. Villa against QPR. Villa, who are +3 from the drop, QPR -4. They're both on winning streaks. QPR a two-game winning streak, Villa just the one.
Yeah, they seem to drift. Last time I was here, I said it's ridiculous. They've only won two games all season, and yet they're two wins away from being back in it. But they've got those two wins. And it's at Villa Park, of course, but I wouldn't be surprised if QPR picked up another victory here. It's all about momentum. Villa are the most obvious example of a team who have got talent, but just don't have confidence. And every time they lose, you think they're going to lose the next one. And the reverse applies. And QPR have got some good players. You know, they shouldn't be in this situation. And with the likes of Remy, maybe Tarab coming back into the side, Hoylett has done well in the past couple of games. So, yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if QPR won.
We did a big thing on QPR on Monday with our chum Michael Han. What about Villa, though? Their whole kind of inexperience thing. Some people are now suggesting that the inexperience could actually help them, in that they're almost too naive to understand the full horror of their situation.
That's football logic, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm not sure I buy that, but I think that they're possibly better when teams come onto them because they've got Agbon Lahore and Wyman on the break, and they've also got Benteke, who's good at long balls. Mm. So maybe it will be a little bit cautious because QPR, again, have been good at defending deep and counter-attacking.
Ooh. KG at Villa Park.
Yeah, KG, 80 minutes, and then all hell breaks loose with all sorts of long balls and
wow,
flying all different directions.
Last five, okay.
Yeah, I agree. I think both teams are much happier when the opposition have the ball and commit men forward. So they're going to be trying to sit fairly deep, and not a lot will probably happen from open play for a long time.
Right, okay. Wigan, in the meantime, who are also in the bottom three, are hosting Newcastle. And they're going to be hoping that a bit of Europa League hangover there for the Magpies, or
falling up at half time in this fixture last season.
Ooh, mate, Wigan were.
Wigan were, yeah. Part of their run where they're the best side of all time.
Right.
It was in April, I think.
They're fresh from beating Everton.
Yeah.
Another win for the Latics?
Maybe. That's so inconsistent, you know. Right. Predicting, yeah, Wigan games there.
I would fancy them in this game, because I think Newcastle are beginning to realise that they won't go down. I mean, they probably knew that throughout the season, but now they have enough points to convince themselves that they've got nothing to do with the relegation fight. And if they progress in Europe, which we, you know, will know by Sunday, of course, I think there'd be bigger fish to fry for them. And this is the kind of game, Wigan away, where, you know, one or two players might not turn up.
All right, Southampton, who are plus four on the bottom three, are taking on that Liverpool side, who are minus seven from the top four, if you're following me here. An extraordinary, extraordinary finale to the season that would be, Liverpool. They're on it. You talk about momentum. Boy, have they got it.
Yeah, they've been very good the last couple of games. Coutinho, I think, has had a little spark. You know, the problem the first half of the season was they just didn't have enough attacking players. And now Sturridge has come in and Coutinho has come in and they can rotate a little bit more. Everyone's looking a bit fresher. They're not depending on the likes of Sterling and Suso, who are talented, but probably 2 years away from being first team regulars.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all coming together. I think it will be a little bit too late for Liverpool, to be honest.
Really?
But I don't think this season was necessarily about the achievements. I think it was about making sure there was, you know, a project in place.
Consolidation.
And they were building something for the future, which you couldn't see under the previous two managers.
Right, Coutinho looks great, doesn't he? He's up against the manager who tried to sign him for Southampton, who had him at Espanyol, of course, Pochettino.
Yeah, and also Liverpool tried to sign Gaston Ramirez last summer, so they were surprisingly competing for various players.
Well, that is interesting. What do you think? 7 points away from the top four, can Liverpool do it? They've got a slightly easier fixture list, people think.
No, I think they've just got too many teams ahead of them. It's not just the points, but you also have to have all the other teams slipping up simultaneously, and I think that's going to be tough.
All right then.
Just on Southampton, you know, Pochettino, despite a lot of praise, they've only won one game under him since replacing Nigel Adkins, who was on seven positive results in nine games or something like that. So, you know, not necessarily the best decision.
No. And interesting, because, of course, there's been another dismissal down at the bottom end of the table, Brian McDermott, which caught a lot of people by surprise, no? That Reading would take this as the moment to have a managerial shake-up?
Yeah, but you seem to get punished for getting promoted sometimes, and I don't think anybody would have expected this Reading side to be able to stay up. I think if you look throughout the team, it's more or less a championship side, and I was kind of surprised that they managed to win the championship last season. They didn't really strengthen to a huge extent in the summer or in January, when actually I think January or February, when Brian McDermott was the manager of the month, they started to pick up a few wins. And Reading, under him, they have a great spirit. Despite looking out of games quite often, they've managed to come back and pick up points in the last minute, especially at home. It's a very unfair decision, and nine games to go, you wonder what they're expecting from whoever comes in.
Russian oligarch in managerial dismissal shocker.
Yeah.
I think this is a case of a sort of an owner thinking, you know, we are going down. If we are going down and I didn't do anything, I probably won't forgive myself. At least I can look myself in the mirror and said, you know, I did what I could, tried to get a new manager. And yes, it is totally unfair, but I think that's how they think. And if somehow, you know, some miracle worker can come in and they go on some crazy run, then maybe there is still a chance. But I don't think it will make a difference.
Robertino making the parallel with the Wolves, who fired Mick McCarthy in similar circumstances last February and who are now battling to avoid relegation to League One.
Yes, a little bit different because Wolves are on a much worse run than Reading were. But, you know, you go down, you have McDermott in charge and you're confident of coming back up, really. And no guarantee that whatever fancy manager that they get in is going to do that.
What's the latest on that?
I was reading this morning that the players don't want De Canio.
Really?
Yeah.
Surprised about that. No. Okay. And he's been cruelly passed up for the job in Rome and now this is as well. Reading have an absolutely rotten record at Man United. I think, is it right that only 1927, an FA Cup win in 1927, apart from that, nothing. Zippo.
That's the classic kind of game. I mean, I always think when a side is winning the league by miles, they just seem to have more easy games than everyone else.
Yeah.
I'm sure Man United have played Reading at home 3 or 4 times this season. They haven't, but it just feels that way. Yet another game they're going to win at a canter.
Hmm. All right. Anyway, not looking good for Reading then. Just to wrap things up, some other games for you. Mentioned the teams ahead of Liverpool. You've got Spurs in third place. They're hosting Fulham. Ooh, a Vertonghen Berbatov class fest there. Chelsea, who are in fourth place, have West Ham. That's a big derby game.
Yeah.
Didn't West Ham beat Chelsea in one of Rafa's first games in charge?
They did. I think it was his third game in charge, coming from behind to win 3-1.
Diarmi. It was all about Diarmi, wasn't it?
Yeah, Momo Diarmi came off the bench and changed the game, basically scored the winner.
Right.
I would expect Chelsea to win this game quite comfortably.
Would you, even after the Europa League exertions?
Yeah, West Ham are very poor away from home.
Really?
Haven't won at Stamford Bridge since a brilliant goal by De Canio in 2002.
Really?
Yeah.
Crikey, okay.
Is that a chip it up and then...
Lobbed it up and then volleyed it in from about 35 yards out.
What a player. West Brom Stoke and moving right along, Everton Man City. Tell you what, terrific off the field, terrific in the literal sense, actually, for Carlos Tevez. It's just like last year's golf course thing. For the second year running, he's been off driving when he shouldn't be. At least that's the allegation.
Probably. He should get his wife to take his parking.
Yeah, okay, but apart from that, Man City, they've won their last 4 games, scoring 12 goals, conceding none. Hello, momentum. Whereas Everton got that smack in the face from the Latics, didn't they?
It's not a great game for City, though, in the last few years, and Everton seem to know how to play a Roberto Mancini side.
How do you play a Roberto Mancini side?
Well, Moyes has always come up with very interesting plans in this fixture. Last year, he man-marked David Silva. He used Jack Rodwell, who, of course, is now at City, but, of course, is injured. And then he used Phil Neville, both man-marking him at different points in the game.
Hmm.
And that was when Silva was at his absolute best. He started last season in tremendous form. So it'd be interesting, maybe barometer of Silva's form, whether Moyes considers him enough of a threat this time to man-mark him again.
Mm,
maybe with Phil Neville.
Mm. A lot of people want David Moyes to go to the Bundesliga, Rafa.
A lot of Everton fans, you mean? Who are these people?
Well, I don't know. People keep saying, oh, he'd do well in the Bundesliga. I keep reading think pieces about that.
I don't know.
Patrick Barkley said it just yesterday, in fact.
Right.
I'd like to see him in the Bundesliga, he said. It's a fancy thing to say.
We would all like to see him at a different club, simply
really?
To see what he can do.
Yeah, okay. But perhaps Reading.
Yeah, in terms of working with the budget, I think he's done pretty well because Everton's budget has been reportedly very, very poor. But he's been there for 11 years now. Perhaps he should have done a little bit better in 1 or 2 cup competitions.
Mm. Is it too late for Bayern to say no to Pep, maybe?
I think it's too late. Mm. And anyway, Mark Hughes has got his eye on the job.
Absolutely. Well, the stick that they took after the Wigan game and the scariness of David Moyes, I reckon that they're going to come out all guns blazing against City and smack them up a treat.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, that's my call.
Okay.
Yeah. Super, that's very much our take on the state of play on this Thursday in the world of football. Haven't mentioned the Qatar Dream Football League, but there'll be time for that. I'm sure. We will have a Euro paper roundup with lots of Champions League reaction and all that kind of thing come Friday morning, so do join me for that. Otherwise, we'll be back on Monday. Many thanks to guest producer Ian, to Jacob Steinberg, Raphael Honigstein, and Michael Cox of zonalmarking.net. And have a super weekend. See you Monday.